Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, flammables, fire, an album that bumps eternally. And today, we will be deep diving together for an album that just turned 25 years old this spring, Hard to Earn, by one of Brooklyn's finest, Gangstar.
Boom, bash, dash, I had to break, I had to get away. Pack my bags to leave for good, it was a Monday. Kissed my mother, gave my pops a pound. Then he hugged me, and then he turned around.
What is a DJ if he can't scratch? What is an MC if he can't rap? Whether these are rhetorical or real questions asked by an Egyptian lover, in the case of Gangstar, we ain't really got to ponder much. The kids from Texas and Boston, respectively, did both things well, and they proved that on their fourth album, released March the 8th, 1994, called Hard to Earn. This album was a flex of skill, of styles, of knowledge, of superiority from a brother named Keith and his cutman Premier. Known professionally as Gifted Unlimited Rhymes Universal, Guru gave us an album's worth of reasons why he was nicer than you, why Gangstar was Brooklyn and beyond, massively appealing, as it were. Less political correctness, more cum correctness from a rapper whose nom de plume in Sanskrit means expert, master, guide, a cognate of the Latin gravis, meaning heavy, mighty. How better to describe this elder statesman, this OG, whose path to his craft was, in his own estimation, no crystal stair? If the intro to Hard to Earn sounds like an old head's "when I was young" speech, then that sounds about right. He was 33 years old and throwing a middle finger up to all you punk MCs. This wasn't gangster rap, it was Gangstar. Jazzy, sophisticated, gritty in places, beautiful in others. A warning to the less qualified that Guru was coming for that ass, that his pen game was mightier than your pen or your sword. His delivery and his voice different, the beats different, and also the time was different. This record reminds me of days gone by, of power couples, Guru and Primo, Pete Rock and CL Smooth, Ice Cube and Pooh, Captain and Tennille, of a time when respect as an MC was actually hard to earn. It is a heat rock without question, and though there are stars with bars on today's rap pages, we're missing a Guru and it shows. Folks are still trying to find their voice and their lane. I stay hopeful, but also aware that there's a long way to go when you don't know where you're going, and you don't know where you're going when you're lost.
I seen a lot of ill shit on my block, happen nightly. East New York is no joke, kid. And peace to my man Haas doing his bid. I went to Flappers to buy incense and weed. Stopped at the bookstands for something to read. And shit was rough cause my pockets was bare. And like the saying goes, sometimes life ain't fair.
Hard to Earn was the album pick of our guest today, the dynamic duo of Vicky Toback and Joseph Patel. Vicky is a longtime journalist, producer, and most recently, the author of Contact High, A Visual History of Hip Hop, which just came out last fall. It is, and I say this without exaggeration, the greatest book about hip hop photography I've ever seen, one that doesn't merely share the stories behind some of the music's most iconic images, but gives long overdue credit to the women and men behind the camera. For those in Southern California, I urge you to visit the Annenberg Space of Photography in Century City to come see the brand new Contact High exhibition that will be there through mid-August. Morgan and I just went to the opening night, and it is incredible. And while you're there, you can watch an equally excellent short documentary made especially for the exhibit that was exec produced by our other guest, Joseph Patel, a.k.a. Jazzbo, who I first met when we were both up-and-coming writers out of the Bay Area writing for Herb Magazine. Shout out to Herb as always.
Shout out.
Joseph went from the writer's desk to the producer's chair, and when he's not sitting behind E-40 and Guy Fieri at Golden State Warriors games, he has been shaping how you, the listener, has experienced contemporary video content thanks to his work at MTV, Vice, The Fader, Vivo, and others. He's currently working on a new feature-length documentary with Questlove of the Roots. He's also one of my oldest friends, and I am delighted to have him and Vicky here with us today. Welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you. This is awesome. Thank you for having us.
We are really thrilled that someone, number one, finally picked a Gangstar album.
Yeah.
And not just any Gangstar album, because if I'm not mistaken, Morgan, this is both you and my favorite Gangstar album, right?
It is.
We will get to sort of the ranking of Gangstar albums in a moment. as this is our show's first entry into the Gangstar catalog at all, can we just kind of go around the horn here and talk a little bit about our own personal relationships to Gangstar? And Vicky, I feel like we have to start with you because you were working for Gangstar's management company, Empire, back when this album came out and through that first early 90s era in which they were really, really coming into their own. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about how that all came together and what did you think of the group when you first encountered them?
I, you know, had moved around that time, had moved to New York from Detroit. I was 19 years old and I was working at a really important nightclub called Nell's at night, you know, doing a bunch of stuff during the day. And someone that I worked with who was sort of, you know, in the club scene plugged in said, hey, you know, there was this former club. It was called Payday, a big hip hop club.
Yeah.
And they are forming it as a label. And they also have a management company associated with it, Empire Management.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking for someone, you know, to come work there. And I was like, yeah, I'm down. And they hired me. They were in a little office on the Lower East Side, giant loft space with no heat. We had little space heaters to keep us warm. And, you know, this was just, they were in the process of recording Hard to Earn. It was still very like bootstrap.
Yeah.
And I came on there, you know, I don't even know if I had like a proper title at first. I kind of just like answered phones and did whatever.
Right, right.
And then, you know, as things started to build, they named me director of marketing and publicity, which is a big title, but I still answered the phone. and so, yeah, and, you know, there were only like five of us working there. And so we were like a small family, you know, as small groups are, you know, and I got really got to work with the group really tightly, not just Gangstar, but, you know, then later Group Home, J. Rue,
right.
The whole Gangstar Foundation.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, traveled with them, was sort of their interface with media and photographers. And, you know, we'll talk more later about it, but, you know, met a lot of the photographers through them, you know, through working with them,
right.
and being their liaison.
Yeah.
It's actually how Vicky and I met. I was a writer on the West Coast up in the Bay Area, and when Vicky would travel with the Empire artists on press runs to the West Coast, that's how we met.
That's right.
Yeah.
With Show and AG.
Show and AG.
Because they were on Payday.
And then Group Home later. I don't know if we met on a Gangstar press run at all, but I think it was Group Home and Showbiz and AG, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Joseph, what was your introduction to Gangstar?
So when I was in college, I was a DJ at the radio station up at UC Davis.
KDVS. Shout out to UC College radio stations.
Yeah. Sure. Shout out to College Radio.
Yeah.
College Radio is
absolutely
just the truth. And I was also writing for hip hop magazines. So I was writing for The Bomb Hip Hop Magazine, Flavor, BAM, which wasn't a hip hop magazine, but a Bay Area music magazine.
Yeah. Herb, of course.
Herb. And so from the first Gangstar song you hear, you become a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a fan. And it's, you know, the first Gangstar song I ever heard, premiere became Godly. And I think Daily Operation had just come out. And I remember buying that CD and just never putting it down. It never left my CD player.
Yeah.
I remember I was the music director at KDVS in 1993 and 1994. I was the hip hop music director before that. And I was uniquely situated in the college radio space in that I wrote for hip hop magazines and I also had a radio show on the air. So my hustle was that I would get the advance cassette of albums 3 or 4 months before they hit the streets.
Yeah.
And would play some of those songs on my radio show. Whereas DJs didn't get advances of albums.
No,
they got
not like
they
that.
Got advances of singles,
sure, but
not albums. And so it was I was able to make a little tiny name for myself because of that. So it was yeah.
Did you ever get in trouble with publicists for that? Cuz I remember getting those cassettes too, cuz like you, I was a writer and a college radio DJ, but the expressed instructions are you're not supposed to be sharing this stuff, but you were like, "Eh."
I mean, who in New York was listening to KDVS?
True. Pre-internet. Right. How would they know? How would they know?
They wouldn't know.
Good job there,
man. And KDVS was interesting because we had 5,000 watts, which is huge for a college radio station.
Mm. Yeah.
It was in Central California Valley. So on a clear night,
you could get that.
You could get it in Reno, okay. Right? Reno, oh, wow. Bakersfield, Stockton to Berkeley.
Yeah.
I had a large prison population in Folsom. Folsom? Is that?
Yeah.
I think so. And so a lot of folks from prison would call every week because our show was really late night. So really, I sort of weighed that. I was like, well, these guys want to hear it.
Right.
The audience wants to hear it. And no one is going to hear it in New York. So I didn't really bug out on that.
Nicely done. For me, I think Manifest, and probably for a lot of people, if you were listening to any hip-hop in the late 80s, Manifest would have been your introduction to Gangstar.
I am effective here, because I select a clear method for all. Suckers I maul, they fall and crawl into the pit of purgatory. I go for glory, I'm taking inventory.
And I think I first got to know them because of the jazz slash hip-hop movement, whether you want to really describe it as such. But certainly, I think that's how Gangstar first made a name for themselves. But by the mid-90s, so by the time Hard to Earn comes out, they make, I think, not a dramatic shift, but a shift towards a new kind of sound that plays exceptionally well with what was happening in hip-hop in general. And a lot of this, of course, is through the work of Chris Martin, a.k.a. DJ Premier, in terms of him working with KRS-One, him working with Jay-Z, him working with, in addition to everyone in the Gangstar Foundation, in addition to Gangstar itself. And so that era of hip hop and Gangstar as being the pinnacle artist within it is my favorite era of rap music, number one. And Gangstar, no one ranked really higher just because of the particular style and sound and what they represented. And even though I wasn't in New York like Joseph, I was living in the Bay Area, but sort of the idea of what New York and hip hop meant, Gangstar was the distillation of that, right? They were the most iconic example that I could imagine then and now. And so that's a big reason why, and we'll come back to this more in a moment, about why Hard to Earn ranks above their other works, because to me it encapsulates what I thought about hip-hop in 94, which was such an important year. Morgan, how about you?
I think we've talked about this on other shows, you know, the challenge of being, for me, being a tried and true West Coaster who loved East Coast hip-hop, and right. How in the closet I had to be about that, fearing my life. No, I'm just playing. But my brother also loved a lot of, you know, East Coast hip-hop. He was like a huge, you know, EPMD devotee, and he's the one that really turned me on to Gangstar. But my earliest memory of them was the Manifest video. And I just remember thinking, like, yo, is this supposed to be like Malcolm X and Martin meeting and talking? You know, Guru had the ill glasses on. They met on the couch, and then he took the mic. And I was like, yo, this is, I'm with it. And then I sort of like jams on. I had jams on Daily Operation. Not my favorite, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
But No Shame in My Game was a favorite. Mm-hmm. X-Girl to the Next Girl was a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And those were my two jams. But if I'm honest, as we've said before, Hard to Earn is my favorite. And I was ready, too, because I was into the whole jazzy, that jazzy hip-hop blend. And this introduced me to a lot of groups that I would like later. This introduced me to Group Home. And I like them on a jam here, but I also like Living Proof.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, for me, the voice. And, of course, like I said, that first video, I was like, okay, these dudes are different. And it was, to me, love at first listen.
Right. So you can't hide from jail and you can't hide from the streets. Lyrics do get deep when they're walking to eat. A unique sound from the underground made the brothers unite. I'm flapping pound to pound with real niggas.
So let's come back specifically to Hard to Earn. And Vicky, this was the album that you wanted to talk about. And given that you work with the group, you obviously know their entire catalog, I'm sure, backwards to forwards. Why pluck out this album specifically? What makes this a heat rock for you?
I was in New York at the time. This album felt like it was a confluence of everything that was happening in New York at the time. It was Brooklyn. It was local. It was the jazz samples.
Yeah.
It was the clubs, right? It was like, you know, all these records got broken in clubs. It was the digging culture. It was the freestyle, like cipher culture, that all that stuff that you really had to, like, you felt it in the street, you know, and just that time, you know, that year, 94, I wanted to pick this album because it felt like a confluence of not just musically, but culturally.
Right.
And from like, you know, when you listen to the lyrics of what was just happening in the culture, I mean, you had a lot, I mean, I hate saying like political rap, but just really highly intelligent, you know, lyrics and the exploration of what was happening in real life in New York and, you know, and in other, you know, urban cities around the country. But yeah, that's why I wanted to.
Is this your favorite Gangsta album, and or do you think it's their best album?
Well, I'm biased, but I think this is probably their strongest. But I don't know, you know, unlike, I mean, Gangsta is one of those groups I feel like, you know, unlike Nas, right, where people are like Illmatic, where it was written, which is like, you know, there's, I to me sometimes I even forget like which song which was on which Gangsta album, like X Girl to the Next Girl. Right, I was like, oh wait, yeah, I thought that was on Hard to Earn. No, like, you know, they're so consistent.
True.
Also, it's funny you say that because I misspoke earlier when I said, like, Step in the Arena is the album I first bought from Gangstar. It wasn't Daily Operation, but it's exactly that notion that Gangstar was a sound, and it manifests, no pun intended, in different albums, but it is sometimes you could just put all of their songs on shuffle and it's so consistent.
Yeah.
I would respectfully disagree only insofar as I do think that with those especially albums, well, we can start with No More Mr. Nice Guy, but if you go through albums 1, 2, 3, and 4 and probably 5 if we throw in Moment of Truth, they all represent different styles and sounds, and there is a consistency in terms of, I think, the chemistry between Guru and Premier is a consistency. I think Guru, of course, his voice is a consistency. Yeah. But the sound of Step in the Arena does not, to me, sound like necessarily the sound of Daily Operation, which definitely, to me, doesn't sound like Hard to Earn or Moment of Truth, even though you can find consistencies there. Like, they're each of them are snapshots of where the group was at. But back to your point, Vicky, I think they're snapshots of where hip hop was at in each of those key years, 90, 92, 94, 97, 98. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think I shouldn't say the sound is similar. It is the consistency, right? Gangstar created a formula, and even though the colors changed, the formula was the same.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny because in any other group, in any other genre, I want people who break out of formula.
Mm-hmm.
Gangstar, I never wanted to break out of the formula.
Yeah.
Because they're just so good at it. And because within that formula, they were able to make songs sound different and create, like you said, snapshots. I think
We're both right.
I think we're both right.
Yeah. No, and I think I love the point that for other artists, you want to see them continually changing, but somehow with Gangstar, it's like, no, whatever you have,
Stay
with it.
Yeah.
And I want to come back to something you said during the intro, which is about Guru's intro on this album and just deciding to open this with it kind of back in the day. I'm the elder statesman. What's up with all these new cats?
Right.
And there's something about that move, which was unexpected because he had not opened previous albums like that.
What's up, girl? It's about time to catch my fucking sleeping. Waking the fuck up. And yo, all you kids who want to get on and shit, just remember this. This shit ain't easy. If you ain't got it, you ain't got it, motherfucker. Suckers be coming up to me on some bullshit, talking about they want to freestyle and shit. Breath stinking like a motherfucker.
Just out there dashing hopes. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like in the beginning of Mass Appeal, like he's like, you'll never make it. And you're like, well, great. So where do I go from here? You know what I'm saying? What's the good news, Guru?
Right.
But that's what I like. The swag was refined on there, and I love that. And in later years, I got into Jazzmatazz. I got into that thing. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But
yeah, because I was gonna say like Jazzmatazz, who was just a year prior,
yep.
And I know people have real mixed feelings about Jazzmatazz.
I like Jazzmatazz.
Oh my god, I know some people who hate
it. Yeah.
I mean, it's something I think that over time has earned its place, but a lot of real purists were like, that shit was the wackest.
But see, I was go ahead. I was just going to say, I was so, at this time, to me, was also, you know, the center of acid jazz. Mm-hmm. So Jazz Matasse fit right into what I was hearing from Young Disciples and Loose Ends and Incognito and Jamiroquai. So I just, to me, it was just like smooth. It was smooth. It was just all that plus Guru.
Well, plus like Premier was, you know, he was sampling all these guys. Right. And then all of a sudden Guru manifested, not to, no pun intended again,
let's intend the puns.
You know, Donald Byrd and Roy Ayers, you know, sure, show up in the flesh at D&D Studios, you Ooh. Know, and it was super cool, you know, because also I think hip hop heads were having this great education about, I mean, a lot of people learned about jazz through hip hop first.
Right, absolutely.
You know, by kind of reverse engineering samples and falling in love with jazz, you know. And so I think that was also, you know, in hindsight, really brilliant of Guru to recognize that and be like, hey, these guys are right here. You know, let's bring them, let's reach out to them.
I think when Premier and Guru brought Branford Marsalis in to do Jazz Thing, was, I think that was the first time that that connection had been made, like physically.
That explicitly, yeah.
Right?
Ain't nothing going on, but simply good music, and you won't refuse it. She's taking her time making the nuances rhyme. Sonny Rollins, tenor saxophone, with a big old tone, reciting poems with notes as words. And haven't you heard?
And then what Jazz Matasse did, I think, not just musically brought those sounds together, but it was a real concerted effort by Guru to link generations.
Absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. And to your point, these cats are still alive, mm-hmm. but also just like know your history, right? At the time, I liked Jazz Matasse because I also was really into jazz records and also mm-hmm. like acid jazz stuff out of London. I then started, and then late 90s, you sort of look back at Jazz Matasse and you're kind of like, I don't know. As it gets older again, like I appreciate, not necessarily for the music, but for what Guru was doing that was just so ahead of its time.
Right.
For culture.
For sure.
For real. So now you got to know the deal. For lounging. Just lounging. Mellow out and just lounging. 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 Mellow out. Check it out. And lounging. Lounging.
We talked a little bit about Tribe and their use of jazz and the jazz sampling. What to you guys are the differences between the way that Gangstar used jazz and the way that Tribe used jazz? We're getting samples. What are the subtle differences to y'all?
All right, so 3 hours. Let's put that aside so we can get into this.
I mean, I think to my earlier point, I think Premier found emotion in the samples and how he paired samples and sounds with beats. And I think Tip and Ali Shaheed, to some extent, their jazz samples were more for color, I think. Right, rather than sound, and I feel like I think they both work, but I think that Premier just dug into it a deeper level.
It doesn't matter if the cops be scoping, they can't do jack. That's why a young brother's open to do anything, anywhere, any place. Buck wild in another court case, it's the code of the streets. They might say that we're a menace to society, but at the same time,
so this is from a Monk Higgins album, and Monk Higgins was never
Little Green Apples. Yeah,
in a cover of Little Green Apples, yeah. Which is not like a song that is. It's not a song out of the funk canon. I think this version of it single handedly kind of put it in there for Sample Hunters. But Monk Higgins, even though he did a lot of kind of jazz funk stuff of that era, was never on the same level as the big cats coming out of Blue Note or Prestige.
Sure.
But this goes back to your point, Joseph, about like of how Primo was able to find something and then flip into something that if you listen to the original of this, you don't get from that point A to this point B in an intuitive way.
Sure.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
This is specifically for you, Vicky. Do you remember the first time you heard Mass Appeal?
Oof. I mean, I would kind of be running back and forth, you know, to D&D where they were recording, back to the office. I'm sure I just kind of like somewhere, I probably heard it in the studio for the first time, but I don't remember like a momentous.
Yeah.
Moment.
Because I remember getting the 12-inch for Mass Appeal, and there was something about it, because Guru talking about quote unquote mass appeal, and his sort of like Heisman Trophy of wanting that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this, but at the same time, ironically, it's probably the most conservative Gangstar single. It was like packaged like a real song, right? And Premier creates a chorus, right? And it's like, it was so funny to me, but it also felt like, oh, this is Daily Operation 2.0, right? It's almost like the way Outkast evolved out of ATLiens into Aquemini.
Sure.
You could same sort of formula, same group, but just better. And it felt like Mass Appeal was like, oh, this album's about to be crazy. It feels like they learned a lot from Daily Operation.
And no, we don't make whack tracks, and all the suckers get pushed back when I'm kicking real facts. I represent, set up shit like a tech boy. You're paranoid cause you're a son like Elroy, and you'd be happy as hell to get a record deal. Maybe a soul you'd sell to have Mass Appeal.
This song is so potent, it launched a magazine named after it. I mean, think about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Shout out to Mass Appeal Magazine.
And the EPMD, because first time I heard this, I was like, you're a customer? And I was like, nope, this is something else. But whatever it is, I love it. Love this song. Not my favorite on the album. We'll talk about this later. But
I also love the video for this, because they're just cruising through New York. And
Yeah,
and it's just it's just a whole vibe. Like that video where they're just in the car and
bumping,
and it's just that was the energy of New York. And if I recall correctly, they shot that like on 125th, definitely uptown.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like, you know, how you felt walking through New York at
isn't
that time.
Isn't it funny that they are in many ways the quintessential New York hip hop group of that era?
But neither are from New York.
Yeah. No. Right?
I know.
And I think that in itself is a New Yorkness, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny because you mentioned EPMD earlier, your brother.
Yeah.
And EPMD was always like, for a lot of people on the East Coast, EPMD was your favorite rapper's favorite rappers.
Mm-hmm.
That Gangstar was that for me, right? Like Gangstar was like, I liked EPMD, but not as much as Fife did. Right.
Yeah.
I liked Gangstar like Fife liked EPMD.
Sure. Sure.
And it felt like very, if you were to play hip hop for aliens, you would play them a Gangstar song.
Sure. I mean, I love EPMD, and my brother loved EPMD. Listening to it now as a music supervisor, I just get so triggered because I'm like, nothing's cleared on here. None of these samples are cleared. Damn it. Come on, guys. I mean, it's still a great album, but it is so triggering because EPMD just left nothing to the imagination. They're like, put the whole shit in there. Put the whole thing in there, right? But God bless EPMD, but it is triggering.
Well, we will be back with more of our conversation about Gangstar's Hard to Earn with our guests Vicky Toback and Joseph Patel after a brief word from some of our Sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Unless you're able to discuss the semiotics of direwolves in Game of Thrones, Inside Pop is definitely not for you.
Sean, that's a little extreme and also not quite true.
Okay, Amita, how about Inside Pop is the podcast for people who love and appreciate the best pop culture has to offer.
Much better.
In every episode, we interview the people who create the culture you crave.
Past interviews include Luke Cage showrunner Cheo Hadari-Coker, the music supervisor of The Florida Project, and Mudbound director Dee Rees.
You'll also get the very best pop culture recommendations in our Big Sell segment.
Plus the opinions of two TV producers who are pop culture obsessives and actually do care a lot about direwolves.
Which, of course, symbolize our inability to truly connect with the natural world without ultimately destroying it and in the process destroying ourselves.
Listen to Inside Pop every other Wednesday on the Maximum Fun Podcast Network.
This is NASA. I see a flat Earth, but we should lie to everybody about it and say it's round. 10-4.
Maximum Fun brings you the latest podcast, an expose on the flat Earth.
I want to take advantage of humankind and make them believe a lie so that they will trust us with the government.
It's all an elaborate lie. And when you get on a plane, they purposefully fly you farther than you need to go.
It's disgusting. It needs to be stopped. And if you listen to Ono, Ross, and Carrie, we will tell you the truth behind the lies.
Just kidding.
No, we won't do that. We will just tell you the truth behind the truth, because what we do is we look at extraordinary claims.
That's right. We've gone undercover with alternative medical treatments, fringe religious groups, fringe science claims, the spiritual, paranormal. We're there to check it out and let you know what happens.
Is the Queen Mary haunted? I don't know. Find out.
We show up. We make friends. We learn what happens when you ask questions, and we tell you all about it.
And we get all that funky stuff done to us.
It's Oh No Ross and Carrie
at MaximumFun.org.
And we are back on Heat Rocks talking Gangstar's Hard to Earn with Vicky Toback and Joseph Patel.
Before we get back to Gangstar specifically, Vicky, can you just tell us a little bit about how did the idea for Contact High, your book about the visual history of hip-hop, and as I said in my intro, really, I meant it. It is the best book I've seen about hip-hop photography. And it feels like it arrives late somehow in terms of, we've had 40 years of hip-hop photography. Why did it take until now for someone to put out something like Contact High?
Well, I think exactly for that reason. You know, 40 years is an archive. 40 years is a story, a visual story, a story of a culture and a music. I always just loved contact sheets of all sorts.
Yeah.
You know, I, being a journalist, seeing those in-between moments and seeing the thought process of the photographers, I just really, you know, love them. And so and also just having worked at later at like CNN and CBS and just seeing how meticulously and seriously they treated their archives. Mm-hmm. I just got the idea one day, you know, to do the same thing for hip hop. And it was the right time. And the more I started thinking about it, I was like, oh, right. Like, I was there for a lot of these shoots. I know a lot of these photographers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also remember, you know, from the artist's perspective, when they had bad experiences with photographers and what those photos ended up being, and then when they had good photographers and how those, you know, photos came out and who had what. And so I just kind of, it was more just a curiosity. And the more I started talking to the photographers, and I actually, you know, started writing it as a column while I was doing the research for Mass Appeal. Yes.
Yeah. Bam. Shout out.
Full circle.
Full circle.
Full circle. Yeah, and so it just kind of built and grew from there, and it was just something that I was really like, oh my God, and then I just knew it had to be a book.
And Joseph, how'd you get involved?
Well, so I'll qualify this by saying, I think it's one of the best hip hop books I've ever seen. Because not just photography.
No, true.
Because it is a...
Right. We don't need that qualifier before.
Yeah.
No,
it is a history of hip hop through a different lens. Mm-hmm. And
no pun intended.
No, actually explicitly intended.
We're all about the right intended puns today.
Because, so I got involved because Vicky was doing this column this incredible story where she asked to Al Pereira to see the photograph and contact sheets for the photo of Biggie and Tupac at the Palladium in 93. And in looking at those contact sheets, they saw...
It was actually Club Amazon. Everyone
Club
thinks
Amazon.
It's
the Palladium. Was the... Right. The Palladium
that was later in the night.
Right. So it was Club Amazon, 1993. And in looking at the contact sheets, they see a pre-Illmatic Nas on stage with Tupac wearing a Biohazard t-shirt. That Al Pereira did not know who Nas was and had boxed him out on the contact sheet.
At the time.
And that story to me is the essence of what Vicky's book is so brilliant at doing, which is illuminating these stories in hip hop, the figures in hip hop who were so part of the culture and the industry and the music that don't get recognized. Right, this another Al Pereira shoot with Queen Latifah. Her mom is in the contact sheets.
Yeah,
her dancers are there. Mm. You see. It also in that Club Amazon one, you see one of the lowlife kids in the shot with Tupac and Biggie. There's just so much history, lived history that you see in the contact sheets that you don't see in the final photos.
Of course, yeah.
And the stories behind those final photos and all the people involved are a part of the culture. So to me, the book is itself a brilliant hip-hop history, just from a different perspective
no
than
doubt.
We're used to.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah, in some ways it even kind of takes me back to my like Payday Records Empire skill set of really making sure your people are taken care of and protected.
Right, right.
Because, yeah, like for a photographer to trust you with seeing their negatives,
yeah,
or even giving you their high-res files, mm-hmm, to scan, their stories, you know, they've been screwed over so much. And it definitely, like, brought me back to that protective, like, mama bear moment that, mm-hmm, you have working with artists too. You're like, that's so crucial to have a person who's just got you. And I'm always in disbelief at also how rare that is.
Yeah.
Even today. Yeah. Especially today, maybe.
Yeah.
Let's bring this back to Hard to Earn. And in particular, I know Morgan had a question about Dwick.
I chant eeny, meeny, miny, mo. I wreck the mic like a pimp shows. Here's how it goes, I am a genius, I mean this. I shape this, you'll tape this. I'm kind of fiendish, you wish that you could come into my neighborhood.
Because I read that was supposed to be on Daily Operations. Should it have been on Daily Operations?
Well, so I think Dwick was originally a B-side to Flip the Script from Daily Operation. And what they found was that college DJs were,
yeah,
playing Dwick.
Yeah.
Because it was just this, first of all, nice and smooth. Just,
come on.
I mean, yeah, so good, right? It was like a party song.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, and in the clubs, that was,
yes,
that was
song.
Good.
Dun, dun, dun,
ah, wee,
yes,
wee.
So good.
Well, and also, like, you have, like, Greg Nice and Gurus. Like, they're, you know, because they both have this kind of, like, finessed, you know, just, and yeah, and so they both their deliveries together on one song,
oh,
are
so
just
good.
Yeah. So good. Yeah.
And so I think people were playing the B side more,
right,
than the A side.
Right, absolutely.
So then they released Dwick as its standalone single. This is still pre Hard to Earn. They released Dwick as a standalone single with the instrumental now and the a cappella. And then, as labels do, right, they're like, oh, we see the numbers. We're going to put this on the next album.
Yeah.
Even though I think stylistically it doesn't fit on Hard
Right.
Earn.
That was my question.
Yeah.
That's why I asked the question. Did you think it fit on Hard to Earn? Should it have been? Yeah.
It would have gone down as one of the greatest B-sides ever had they not put it on Hard to Earn.
Yep.
In some ways, I kind of wish they had it. And I think to your point, because it doesn't sound like it actually fits.
Uh-uh.
And because anyone who knew about the song knew that, well, y'all put this out 2 years earlier. Now you're putting it on this next album. But it doesn't really work stylistically with,
yeah,
it. It's not like I'm mad at it being there, but it doesn't need to be there.
And
it
comes right smack dab in the middle of the record.
Right.
It just feels weird. But I don't know if that's just us because we had heard it earlier, or if someone who didn't know that Dwick existed,
right,
prior to Hard to Earn, if they would have felt the same way.
Right.
When they feel afraid, too late. When they dip in the kick, they get sprayed. Lemonade was a popular drink, and it still is. I get more props and stunts than Bruce Willis. A poet like Langston Hughes and can't lose when I cruise.
During the break, we actually got into whether or not Dwick is pronounced Dwick or D-W-Y-C-K. If it's an acronym, and it appears like an acronym, what did the acronym stand for? Because I don't know this.
I heard it was Do What You Can, Kid.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Knowledge dropped.
I did not know that. 27 years after that
song.
The
fact that, like, you never even question it. You just kind of accept, like, yeah, it's Dwick.
Yep.
You know what I always thought it was? I always thought it was this. I thought Dwick was the sound of a Primo scratch on the song, and they called it Dwick off that. That's all what I always thought it was. I never knew it was an acronym for anything.
I mean, Vicky, you were at the label. What's
I don't remember.
Really,
I don't remember. Like, can we text Primo right now? I more remember that song from the perspective of going to the clubs at,
yeah,
the time.
Man.
Like that was on heavy rotation in the clubs.
When
that
people
was
used
great.
To dance to,
right,
when people used to dance to Gangstar,
sure,
and you know, and the Lemonade line is just. I mean, I feel like
it was a popular drink, and it still is.
Yes.
Bruce
Willis.
Another interesting moment on the album was I Chill, and I have on this show really gone to bat for voicemail. I feel like voicemail is what's missing in contemporary music today. Voicemail messages.
Beats, so give me a call so I can ask you these questions and shit. Work this shit out. All right, chill.
I was like, I cannot wait till we talk about I Chill.
Bring voicemail back.
when I did Jeff Mao's podcast, he was like, what's your favorite Gangstar song of
you're
all
like,
time?
You're like, I Chill.
I was like, I Chill.
Word? But it's dope that everyone finishes
and he was
saying,
he died
I Chill.
Laughing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, okay, and we'll go out with I Chill. Like, but I just, you know, this, I love it so much because it's like, again, it just takes you inside, like, how, you know, these guys were with each other. Yeah. Like, you just feel that love and that, like, you know, and even, like, you know, Doug from, you know, D&D, Doug and Dave of right. D&D Studios is even leaves a right. a voicemail on this. And it's just, I feel like it's just like a little glimpse into their real life, like real life.
But also a glimpse into the culture, the slang, the background music, the language, right? Like that is, I think, what is preserved for me in this interlude.
Yeah, what up, man? It's Nate, baby. Kicking it out here in the hood, Compton, you know what I'm saying? Dipping you out on the new album. I did you in the studio, you know what I'm saying? Dropping them fat beats. So get back with me on it down and low. All right, chill.
Here's what I need to know. How did this get set up? Did Premier call up his friends and be like, can you leave a message, but always make sure you end it with this phrase?
So here is a Heat Rock hot take. I thought about this on the drive.
Let's do this.
I thought about this on the drive over here. Listening to that interlude again this many years later, when it first came out on the album, I thought it was, oh, this is funny because all these people called Premier and he put it together. Listening to it again, it was definitely contrived.
Oh.
And my theory for that is because everyone mentions where they're from. Oh, this is so-and-so from East New York. This is so-and-so. I'm up in the Bronx. This is so-and-so. Blah, blah, blah.
I was going to say, I bet it's a mix. And I wish I knew the answer.
I bet it is a mix.
Because the
Nas
one does not sound contrived. Yeah. That one truly just sounds
But the Mr. C one sounds scripted. Yeah. The one right. from the, dude,
I bet it's a mix. And actually, I don't know the answer of whether it was, but I was like a couple months ago. I actually I'm like Sarah because Sarah Honda talks to Primo a lot more than I do now. But I was like, can you ask Primo like about I Chill like just for my person? I was like, you know, because now that I think about it, I'm like, well, how did that get made? But so on a follow up podcast, we will.
I need to believe that that's real. Because if this is contrived, then the Mary voicemail thing
is contrived. I bet it's a mix.
And that's just too big for my head right now. So just let me keep my feeling that it actually happened. I need that.
I have a lot of favorites even within that one song. But Master Ace calling up to say, Primo, I need you to show me how to use this equipment. which is a lot to admit from a contemporary. Like, he's acknowledging, like, yo, I don't know how to work the SP or the whatever, you know? Like, you need to come here and show me. So, I always like that.
That's honest.
Let's get it. So, you said this is your favorite Gangstar song, which is great. No, I love that. It says so much about you. I feel like I know you so much better for that answer. For each of you, what is the fire track off of this album?
I have gone back and forth because I love Mass Appeal. It bumps and it's fire. But my fire track is Tons of Guns.
Mm.
I know a kid who just passed the other day. They shot him 16 times, so there he lay. You can pray for the shit to like cease. But until then, a nigga's gonna pack a piece. And yo, the devil's got assassination squads. Wanna kill niggas cause they're scared of God.
Good things happen when you put Three Dog Night with Isaac Hayes and Malcolm X. And it is, I mean, the way that that Guru rides that beat, it's a little bit chaotic, it's moody. And the message that he's talking about violence and he's talking about systemic challenges, that to me is just fire. And I love Mass Appeal. I go to the grave saying that's fire, but Tons of Guns is it for me on here.
I had a really hard time answering this only because there's so many songs off of here that could fit. But I think for me, it actually was the last song on the album, which is Coming for That Ass.
Dead Ass.
That Ass. Thank you.
Yes, I'm cranking. Just like an Alpine, a deadly rhyme, brand spanking new. Pump to put some lead in your crew. A hollow point shot, cause your weak, shallow point's not hitting. Should have gave up from the beginning. But since you're bluffing with your tape that's trash, tell your peeps that we coming for that ass. For that ass.
It's a few things. I love the way that it bounces.
Yeah.
It's a flip of a song that a lot of people have taken on, but not necessarily flipped it this particular way, which is the Emotions Blind Alley, which is just one of the best songs off of Stax Volt from the early 70s, and the way that Primo works with it. And I just love that it's this last song on the album. And this is a pretty long album. I mean, it's 17 tracks. So by the time you get here, it would be easy to understand if one would have felt a little bit tired. And oftentimes, not every artist thinks about how to end an album on something that's going to be a little bit more up. And this, to me, was like the perfect way to end an album mm-hmm. that leaves you even wanting for a track 18, 19. Mm-hmm. Because if that's how good track 17 is, gotta just imagine what comes next. So, yeah.
What? I'm curious, like, what did you guys think about, you know, the artists that were sort of introduced, like the Gangstar Foundation, you know, J.Roo? Mel and Dap.
My number two choice in terms of Fire Track probably would have been Speak Your Clout.
Yeah.
Which is, it's basically the part two of I'm the Man, which was on the previous album. And I love beat suites where you give basically, you switch up the track. In this case, each of these three people, right? J.Roo, Lil Dap, and then Guru each get their own beat. But especially the J.Roo track that opens it is so, so fire. Chumping me, but now like chicks, they all beat up on me, and me so horny, I hit them like a groupie, snatch off my hat, wash my dick, and keep it moving, showing and proving, on a day-to-day basis, I rip New York, and a million different places, state to state, country to country. I mean, J.Roo really came into the game with, even before Come Clean, because he had that incredible verse over the Charles Mingus loop off of You're the Man, he's got Speak Your Clout, then he comes with Come Clean. And then
Return,
it goes into his...
Return of the Crooklyn Dodgers.
That's too.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
By the way, that song, Return of the Crooklyn Dodgers,
yeah,
is one of the best songs ever made in hip-hop.
Period.
Like it is just... Oh. Listen, because for your mind, I got the right nutrition. We keep shit hard like fat asses in cases of Heineken. Here in Brooklyn, home of the warrior and villain. Tripe-type chicks, top villains. The anthem, Rasta smoke marijuana. Enterprising businessmen shoot dice on the corner. Excuse me while I light my split, but some choose to sip. So bullets.
Oh, my God.
But, Joseph, I gave you the last spot so you could think about this. What is the Fire Track a hard to earn?
All right. Suckers Need Bodyguards.
Yeah.
Because I always, it's not the hardest track. I think Code of the Streets is really good. I think Tons of Guns is just like on some next level.
Yeah.
I'm just going to give some love to Suckers Need Bodyguards. Because there's a particular thing in hip hop where dudes singing together on the hook. I just love that. It's just so.
It's like sharing an umbrella.
Yeah. It's kind of like, it's like, you know what I mean? Like, I just always imagine, like, what is the studio session like?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a part of hip hop that doesn't exist anymore in the same way, right? You have dudes who sing and.
Right.
And,
but not like chorally.
Yeah, you have individuals who sing, right?
Right, right.
But not harmonizing together. And it's just like, it's just funny to me. And it's so tough, but it's so tender. Run, step, yeah, bounce, nigga, bounce. My rhymes are cargo when yours is just a quarter ounce. Fake MCs, they always act hard, but won't walk the streets without their bodyguard. I hate fake MCs. But I also love the 12-inch because The Question Remains is the B-side.
Speaking of B-sides.
B-side. And that, The Question Remains is one of my favorite Gangstar songs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Phrases I spit like slugs after I sip from my mug. Life is bug. The baseline groove is my drug. Now that you feel me, you'll hear some advice. All your foul niggas gonna pay the fucking price. So take that phony hardcore look off your grill.
What's your favorite moment on this album?
For me, it comes on The Planet.
Same.
Which I don't think is just one of the best autobiographical rap songs. And there's a lot out there to choose from. This is not only one of the best of that bunch. I just think it belongs to the pantheon of great American songs, which is about the risks and the sacrifices, the anxieties that people make, absorb in order to pursue their dream. And to me, there's no better distillation of what I love about the song and love about Gangstar than this moment where he talks about how he used to lay up in the crib listening to Red and Marley, wishing that he was on Kid. Cause I found out about a rep, and I ain't going out being no bitch's pet.
But anyway, I used to lay up in the crib listening to Red Marley, wishing I was on kid. Saved my dough, stayed on the down low, lounged and drank 40s with Tommy Hill and Gusmo.
Because it's not about how I made it from zero to hero. It's about that interstitial moment where he's still trying to figure stuff out. And he's just lying at home, listening to Red Alert and Marley Marl on the radio, wishing that he was on. And there's something about that, the hopefulness of it, the optimism, but also acknowledging, like, you know, I left home. I made a big decision to do this, and who knows if it's going to work out. I just think this song is so amazing. And that is just, yeah, it is my favorite moment.
That's your favorite moment. Mine, I have two. The beginning of Tons of Guns, which is the Malcolm X.
If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it's wrong to be violent, defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it's wrong for America to draft.
But that's my thematic favorite moment.
Yeah.
Sonic favorite moment is the beginning of Planet. Because it's that rock, it's that Taj Mahal. And I sort of hoped that it would stay rock. So when it went different, I was like, okay, I like the song. Right. But I love the beginning of that. I think that sample is hard.
That is actually my favorite moment of the album musically. That because Pete Rock and Premier did that. Oh, I got a loop and I'm just going to do it as a little interlude. I'm not going to turn it into a song. You would have turned it into a song, but I'm going to go from this little thing that's a dope ass loop.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do another loop.
Yeah.
It was like throwaways.
Yeah.
You're the confidence to do that, right? Like, it's just so. It's so such a flex to me.
Right.
A complete flex.
And that beat, if some other producer were to turn that into a whole other song and just been like, look at me, I'm so... and Primo's just like, I'm going to give you 10 seconds.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I'm like, please, let's keep going.
But Vicky, do you have a favorite moment?
I'm going to say just Guru's sentiment on Mass Appeal. So he was a little older than most rappers the time. And he kind of... not struggled with that, but just sort of, I know leading up to this album, you know, it was a lot of just personal, like, struggles with that and struggles with other things. And so I just love on Mass Appeal, he just calls bullshit on all of it and kind of claims his place and his moment.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm dope, but don't wet that. I've suffered setbacks, but now I'm making greenbacks. Just like baggy slacks, I'm crazy hip-hop. Check 1, 2, and you don't stop. Your head'll bop when I drop my crop of pure bomb. Just like the seashore.
In prep for the chat today, what did you hear differently listening to Hard to Earn this time around than the first time? What things did you notice that you might have missed?
It just made me think about the, you know, just the concept of sampling and crafting. And how in many ways that has been so, I don't want to say lost, but just rethought and remixed in this day and age by the younger generation that where there's such a disconnect, you know. And the other thing, you know, listening to this album again so many years later is that nerdiness of samples, that competitiveness that diggers had with each other of, you know, oh, do you know, but you know that, but you know that.
Also, if you know it, I'm flipping it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I miss that camaraderie of nerds.
Shout out to nerds.
Yeah.
Shout out to nerds.
I would echo that. That is, music doesn't sound like this anymore. And I miss it.
Well, for each of you, if you had to describe Hard to Earn in 3 words, and you can't use Hard to Earn as those 3 words.
Not fair.
What would each of you choose?
I can't do 3 words. I can do 2 words.
All right.
Boom bap.
Mm.
That's it. This is a boom bap record.
Boom bap record. That's 3. There you go.
There you go. It's a boom bap record. It's just so, just coming off of what we were talking about an era missed. I'm not... You know this about me. I'm not an I'm not an old head who thinks that things were better back then necessarily.
Not at all. Right.
Sure.
I personally just miss this. Yes. This is what you were talking about, Vicky, the competitiveness and the connection and just like trying to, we're all in this together, but I'm still going to try to one up you. Like, I love that, right? But just the boom bapness of it. I miss that sound.
Yeah, I guess piggybacking on that. Is backpack one word or two?
Oliver?
We'll allow
it. And I am a writer.
However you need to make this work, we're flexible here.
It's a little too close to Joseph's words, but yeah, backpack. Like all those, I miss, you know, the kids and the ciphers.
Yeah.
I miss that in-person thing that I think, I mean, I have two young sons, right? And they do so much of this music nerding out virtually and by themselves, you know, but I mean, by themselves, but, you know, online. And so, you know, I'll just say backpack because that just reminds me of the kids just walking around with all their stuff and their backpack in, you know, downtown New York and hopping into their ciphers. And, you know, I miss the in-personness of it.
Well, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guests, Vicky Toback and Joseph Patel. You can catch Vicky's book, Contact High, A Visual History of Hip Hop, which is out now in stores. The exhibit Contact High is running at the Annenberg Space for Photography in Los Angeles through mid-August. What are each of you working on right now?
I'm about to produce a feature documentary, my first.
Yeah, congrats.
Thanks.
Can you talk about it a little bit?
Nope.
Okay. But this is the one with Questlove.
Questlove is involved in this.
Cool. And Vicky? I mean, you obviously got a lot going on with the book and the exhibit. And,
So the exhibit just opened. So we're going to have several months of it being up in events, talks. We have a film series with Delicious Pizza coming up. And then after that, we're going to travel the show. You know, it has to go to New York next.
Yeah.
And then hopefully travel it. Joseph and I are also working to turn this into, you know, a television series and a longer documentary.
Yeah.
So that's on deck. And then I'm working on a follow-up book.
That we'll leave there.
Okay. Yes.
And where can people find y'all online?
Contact High has its own Instagram. It's at Contact High. Mm-hmm. And I'm at Vicky Toback, my personal.
Twitter and Instagram is at JazzBeezy, JazzBeezy.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess, one of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Max Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. One last thing, here's a teaser for next week's episode, which is from our recent live show featuring Guy Branum talking to us about Ani DeFranco's Plastic Little Castle.
When trying to think about the album that I love most, my mind did go through dorky options and very poppy options and that sort of thing. But I don't think that there's been an album that, like, I listen to in its entirety and means things to me in its entirety as much. Like, it hit me at just the right time with just the right sort of thoughts to really be something and the right level of, like, gentle sellout poppiness. Like, this is the moment when Ani DeFranco leaves behind the teeming armies of lesbians who loves her and engages in the first of her multiple marriages to men. And, you know, is like a year before this on the My Best Friend's Wedding soundtrack. So there is this beautiful mix of pop and sort of like individual perspective on the album that I just love.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.